Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called actually, but the place that we're going to be in is called Menla, and it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is Somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person. Hey friends, before we begin the episode, I want to remind you that my next 6-week course begins on February 21st. Registration opens on January 19th and closes 1 week afterwards. I will be hosting a free webinar on Wednesday, January 19th with a Q&A to describe the course and answer any questions you might have. For more information, visit holisticlifenavigation.com. Now let's get back to the episode. On today's episode, I welcome Bill Riddick, who helped desegregate a school in the 70s through the charrette process.
And you have the opportunity to make that little spot into something that is useful for the world. And so you have to understand where you stand, who you are, and what it is you want to be. And that's it.
Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast. I'm your host, Luis Mojica. I was sick and depressed until I discovered that I could make music. And then my whole life transformed because I began learning how to listen more deeply. Listen to life, to the people around me, and to my body. And that's when I realized that the body speaks through sensations, and learning this new language meant relearning my body and mind. I soon healed myself of many chronic conditions and then began teaching others how to do so as well. Holistic Life Navigation combines nutrition, self-inquiry, and somatic experiencing to help you release stress and trauma just by listening to your own body. This podcast serves as a place to share my experiences, as well as the experiences of many others who have healed and are healing through unique, unorthodox, and unusual ways. Your time to learn begins now. I am so thrilled to be sharing this interview with you all because this man is a big part of our history in America. I was watching the movie Best of Enemies a year ago, and it's on Netflix, so you can watch it. It's called The Best of Enemies, and I was so moved by it. The acting was so good. The story was so incredible. And then I realized it was a true story, and I thought, oh my goodness, that means these people are alive. And to give you an intro to what to expect so you understand and have some context to this interview, Bill Riddick is a therapist, and he was asked to lead a charrette process in Durham, North Carolina in 1971. The schools were segregated then, and the black school had been set to flames, and these children needed somewhere to go to school, but they couldn't integrate with the white kids. So they asked this man to do a charrette process, which initially was about urban planning, and under his thumb, or his heart, we could even say, turned into something more cultural and racial, healing cultural and racial trauma, if you will, through the charrette process. So it's essentially a mediation process where you identify an issue, you look at who or what's the conflict of the issue, and then you essentially speak freely to learn about what's happening on the other side. What's creating the conflict? Why does this person feel the way they feel? And what's so powerful is, so the characters in the movie who were real people, Anne Atwater was a African-American civil rights activist, and she lives in this town with C.P. Ellis, who is a white Ku Klux Klan leader and member. And Bill Riddick goes to this town, Durham, North Carolina, and he has to look for people on, I think, what's called the steering committee. And it's essentially the kind of like if you imagine being in a room and there's a panel in front of you, and one side represents one part of the room, the other side of the panel represents the other demographic or population of people in the room. So he has C.P. Ellis on one side, representing the white side and the Klan's members, and he has Anne Atwater on the right side, representing the black community. Now that's intense, right? And he is trying to figure out, how do I, in 10 days, because the charrette process is 10 days long, in 10 days, how do I get these two people who are so ethically, spiritually, morally, politically opposed, how do I get these two people to start learning from each other, to start sharing? What I find so powerful about this interview is there's these moments he speaks about that are really pivotal. And the first was within himself. He found himself really disgusted and frustrated with both of them because of how disrespectful they were being toward one another. And he went home and was going to quit. And his wife said, "You need to go and be with yourself and get straight with yourself." So he spent the whole night, I think he said he got 2 hours of sleep, just sitting in himself and learning his own biases toward these two people. And the next day when he showed up, he brought a level of respect to them that he hadn't before. And he started to notice something shifting within them. He was respecting them, and they could feel that, and something changed. And he didn't use this language. He's not a somatic therapist, but it's in that field of resonance and attunement. When I respect you, your body, you feel that on a cellular level. That's not intellectual. It's something I have to even say I'm doing. You'll feel that. Whether you want to give me respect back or not, that's a different situation. But you're going to feel that. And guess who else feels it? I'm going to feel it. So Bill was able to sit through this 10-day process with diametrically opposed people and within himself maintain a level of respect and curiosity for both sides. And one thing that he learned and he teaches us in this interview is that something that we oppose about someone else or something someone opposes in us, that thing that's being opposed, that's sacred on both sides. Whether it causes harm, whether it is ignorant, offensive, discriminatory, racist, to the individual clutching to it, it is sacred to them. So fighting against or putting down someone's sacredness is not really going to get us anywhere. So he speaks about a really radical example of where he honored both of their sacred requests. And from there, shifts started to happen. I'm not going to tell you how it ended. It's amazing. And it's something you definitely want to stay tuned for and listen in the episode. And then when you watch this movie, oh my goodness, if you haven't seen it, you're going to have such a depth of understanding after you listen to Bill. I was so, you know, happy to have him on. It took me months to get a hold of him. It didn't take me months to get a hold of him. Getting a hold of him was really easy, which was shocking. But it took many months to actually get the interview to happen because there were issues on both sides technologically. But I was so happy he was able to sit down with me. And I think the timing just couldn't be better. You know, Byron Katie is one of my favorite teachers. She teaches self-inquiry, a process called The Work. And one thing she talks about is mass hypnosis, which is when a concept goes out and huge crowds of people attach to it and believe it's reality. One thing that I find is absolutely necessary for humanity in general, but especially for Americans, is that we learn how to be curious about others, that we don't take others at face value, or we don't take what the news is telling us to feel about others, or what the news is telling us about others, or what social media tells us, or a friend even tells us. We are so multidimensional, and many of the things that we do that are harmful or closed-minded are from a traumatized, reactive place, and it's a fraction of an individual. It's not the whole individual. This conversation with Bill Riddick reminds me of that, that looking at someone and thinking you know them and making a bias on them, first of all, how much that hurts you, but how that just creates another wall of division between you and that person. I think the only way we're able to build capacity for disagreement, build capacity for discomfort, build capacity for learning how I'm just like you is through curiosity. You know, this thing that you do that I don't like or I hate or I think should be illegal, I want to understand why you do it. I don't want to just say it's wrong, even though it may be. I want to understand it. Because removing it from you or oppressing it through law doesn't heal it or shift it in you. It doesn't heal or shift it in me. It just pauses it temporarily until it inflames itself again, culturally. I also find it important to say one reason that I love, that I really work with in my mind and personally, a lot of Black teachers and leaders, is because when you grow up in a world or you develop in a world where so much is opposing you and you're still able to have an open heart and you're wise and you're loving and you're kind and you create a safety in yourself, that's what I call a master. And it amazes me with Bill that he was so used to racism. He was so used to, he speaks in the interview about everyone in his town, or to be the sheriff in his town when he was growing up, you had to be a member of the KKK. He grew up in that world. His body was bathed in that environment. And he was able to stay connected to himself, to not internalize the racism onto himself or the negativity onto himself. And my dear friend Lindsay, who was on the Juneteenth episode a little while back, she said the same thing. You know, her and her parents, they grew up not taking in the stereotypes that were made about Black people in America. And as someone who's intersex and who had a body that was so different and having a grandfather of color, it was always in my blood too. I didn't experience it on any level like someone would of a skin color difference. But I experienced it in my being. I experienced the being bullied and being assaulted and being made fun of and not feeling safe in my body. And there's something it does to you when that's kind of like your everyday, where you either disconnect completely or you connect even more deeply within yourself. And then from your own pain, you learn to understand other people's pain, not to bypass what they're doing to you, but to not become filled with shame or rage or hate toward them, because then you would just be matching their frequency, the very frequency which drove them to the violent, harmful behaviors you experienced. And when I was sitting with Bill, that's the energy I was getting from this man. This just love for himself and understanding of others so he doesn't get rattled by the things around him. And I'm just very honored I got to sit with him and learn from him. So let's have a moment to dive in and listen and learn. And welcome Bill Riddick to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Glad you invited me.
It was very magical finding you, I have to say, because I watched the movie. I was immediately inspired. I typed in your name. I did all this sleuthing, and I find this phone number in like a public record.
And I wondered, is this really his number? And I called and you answered. It was like, blew my mind. So
that's good.
That was pretty cool. I just first want to thank you for your work and for taking some time to speak with me. My audience is going to love this. And I want to start just by letting you introduce us to you. Like, tell us a bit about you. Tell us about how you found the Charette process. Let's start with that. Then we'll go into other stuff.
Okay. I'm from Eastern North Carolina, grew up on a farm. My parents were tenant farmers. I don't know if you know what that word tenant means.
Tell us.
But that is you live on the farm and the farm belongs to somebody else. And they give you a shack to live in and you do the work. And they, at the end of the year, will add up all the stuff and give you $4. And, you know, I'm just saying that's how it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I got off the farm, went to North Carolina, A&T, got a degree in agriculture engineering. Didn't like that because I didn't like the dirt, although I was raised on the farm, and went back to school to do continuing education with a special interest in counseling adults. That's kind of my history in the sense of schooling. The Charette came by me. I was at Shaw University, had just gotten there, and the Office of Education had given Shaw University the money to hold a Charette in Raleigh, North Carolina, around the whole business of urban renewal. And they were going to go through and just wreck a whole Black community. And I couldn't even spell the word Charette. And the guy who was doing all of this just asked me to help. And I said, okay, no problem. The third night of the Charette, at that time, the Charette ran 10 days. The third night of the Charette, Shaw students asked all white people to leave. Now, I'm an administrator. I don't know the name of a single student. I've been there 2 months. He walks up to me and say, you did this. I know you did this. And I'm going, I don't understand what you're saying. Because I think he went by my dress. You know, back in the day, we wore the dashikis and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And he was a shirt and tie person. And got real close to me, which, you know what that means.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm out of here. You run it. And I'm going, I don't even know what this is.
Mm.
The guy from the Office of Ed kind of explained to me in details kind of what it was. I got the students back the next night. And that's how I got into this business of doing charrettes.
Wow.
That went so well until they invited me to go to Indianapolis, Indiana, to build a new school. What should that school look like for minorities? And that went good. And that's the history of it.
So you were dropped into it.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I love that. I love how that works. And by the way, my grandfather was a tenant farmer.
Okay. So you know what I'm talking about.
I do know what you're talking about. So that's interesting. I love that you were, you know, I love hearing people's stories because in my mind, you know, we think, oh, Bill went to school, then he decided to do the Charette process. But I love how life just hands it to you. You don't really know what you're going to do you?
That's exactly right. And I was actually, nobody knew it, but I was a little bit afraid. The city and everybody was into this thing and it was an important issue. And I was really a little bit out of my range, yeah. I thought.
Yeah.
But the next night, the kids came back and they said, well, where are all the maps and where are all the other stuff that we need for this? I said, well, you told the white people to leave. They had the maps. I don't have any maps. So we invited the white people back. It turned out to be a tremendous thing. We the city decided not at that time to do that urban renewal stuff. The black community stayed intact. 5 or 6 years after then, though, you know, it got to be the prime downtown was a prime place. And they did buy out that community and destroyed it. But they did provide some places for people to go. They didn't leave them stranded.
I'm curious now, before we get into some other things, what is the charrette process? Tell us what it is and how it works.
The charrette process actually started in Paris.
Paris, got it.
Right. Students were assigned to go around the city and draw buildings of what they wanted to draw. And on their way back, if they had not finished, in the back of the chariot, they would finish on their way back to school. And that's where the word charrette came from. They were charretting, you know, trying to get back to school on the chariot. And all of that then got just transferred into charretting.
Oh, so interesting. So
that's how it got its name.
Oh, very cool. So then how'd the process become to be?
Okay, the process really got started with engineers. What people would do, say you're trying to span a river. They would lock these guys in a room and throw them some hay to eat. And say, don't come out of this room until you have this bridge completed, which means that all of them had to somehow agree of how to do it. And that was how we used it in America for a good long while. And then the Office of Education picked it up in building schools. And because at the point that they picked it up, there was, you know, integration of schools was on the map. The law had already been passed, and they wanted the community then to get involved in where were you going to build other schools. But that was not how we got into the one in Durham. After I had done, I think, 3 charrettes, they came to my office and said, and by this time I'd left Shaw University, and said, we want you to do 2 charrettes in North Carolina around school desegregation. Okay, and gave me some money. And when they gave me the money, he said, I need to talk to your bookkeeper. So don't have a bookkeeper. He said, well, we need for a nonprofit to be able to do this. I had worked with the guy before I came to Shaw on getting the first black mayor in a southern city elected. Wilbur Hobby was the AFL-CIO name. And Howard Lee was the guy who got elected in Chapel Hill as the first black mayor of a southern city. So I knew the guy. So I called him up and said, hey, man, AFL-CIO is a nonprofit. And he said, yeah. I said, will you take some money for me? And he said, sure, I will. And I put the two of them together, and that's how we got the money to do 2 charrettes in North Carolina. And they were at my discretion.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, now this is interesting because you're talking about a process, essentially a mediation process that started with engineering to decide and unanimously say, okay, this is where we're going to build a bridge or this is how we're going to plan a city. But then this was a leap for you because it went from engineering into cultural, racial, even psychological, right?
That is true. That is true. But I got a good taste of that with the charrette in Indianapolis. We got a real go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And when we finished the school opened at, say, 8 o'clock in the morning and didn't close till 11 o'clock at night. All kinds of community activity. The community actually owned that school. The only thing that they wanted that I just said, no, we're not going to do this. They wanted people who had to meet there. If you're on probation, they wanted folks who didn't have time, or, I mean, didn't have the transportation to get uptown. And I said, you can't put these people who've been convicted of a crime on this campus with kids. You just can't do that. And I won that one. So, but they built the school, and it was a fantastic thing.
So before we go to this historical case in Durham, I mean, they're really all historical cases, but the one that we know about through the movie, I want you to explain to us how the process itself works. What makes it unique? Like, tell us about that.
Here's how the process works. The first thing you have to do is define for yourself the issue. And whatever you're building a school, up in Pennsylvania, it was the fact that schools were not working. Healthcare was poor. You have to decide the issue you're going to deal with. And for the charrette manager, then you have to look at who is it you can talk to who is diabolically opposed to each other. And in Durham now Durham is only about 20 miles from Raleigh. The film makes it sound like it is 200 miles from Raleigh, but
yes, it does.
It's right down the street. I knew some people there. And Durham at that time, you know, they call it the Black Wall Street because there were so many Black businesses there. You probably have heard that. Mm-hmm. And if you read the book that I can't think of his name right now, wrote, you know, he wrote about that. But I thought I had some friends there, because we had worked together and community projects. When I got there, nobody in that, let's call it middle class community who were Black, who wanted to say it. No, man, I can't ruin my name with this stuff, man, you know? And so I had to go looking.
So wait, you're saying when you went to Durham to do the charrette process for this
it just issue started, around segregation? I'm just starting it.
You're just trying to build. I see. You get to town. You're trying to build the panel essentially to come on.
I'm trying to put together a steering committee.
Got it.
And
the Black people would not. They're like, no way. I'm not going to ruin my reputation.
Yeah, the ones that I wanted, the ones that had a little power in the city.
Interesting.
That's where I was pointed.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, somebody said there's a woman named Ann. Somebody at that time, you need to go talk to her.
Ann Atwater, right?
Yeah, but she wasn't. Well, Ann Atwater, but you know, at that time, they call her something else, I think.
Okay.
But anyway, that's not here nor there. I went to see her, and she represented a group of citizens in that town that were very different. They're all Black people now, but they're very different from the people who were at the top of the scale. And they was not happy about her, although when they wanted to get reelected to something, they had to count on her to go get the vote. But otherwise, she was not part of that community.
Mm-hmm.
Although she represented a large group of people, because Durham had a population of poor people like any other city. In that sense, I picked the right person. I talked back to the guy who ran the AFL-CIO and said, man, look, I can't get any white people to talk to me. He said, well, look, I'm tell you, I know a guy who's head of the Ku Klux Klan. And I said, what the hell? Excuse me.
Of course. That's what I would have said.
Are you joking? He said, I know him. And I know he'll at least talk to you. So he gave me the address of his service station. And I went to his service station. And he came out with a wrench or something in his hand as if he had been working. I took it to be a weapon.
Sure.
And I told him who sent me. And he got a little bit relaxed. That I want to talk to you about school desegregation. Oh, it's not going to happen. Now, the middle class folks, children, some of them were already in white schools. A few, not a lot, just a few. And of course, I don't even think he knew that because his children were in elementary school. And hardly anybody in elementary schools, that the first black kids who went to, quote, white schools were all in high school, a middle school or high school. And I asked him, would he be willing to just have a meeting and lunch meeting and sit down and talk about it? So he said, yeah, I think I'll do that. So Ann and I went to this restaurant and he came in and saw it was Ann, which I had not told him about, but he knew her and hated her. And she hated him. And she said, is that the fool I got to work with? He wouldn't sit down. He just walked around. Finally, about 5 or 6 feet from us, he got a chair and sat down. And we talked about this, and he was very short, very short. And finally just got up and left. I went back to the service station and said, look, if you can represent your folks and you can get them to tell this community that desegregation is not a proper way to go, then I think you need to come. And I said, but now you don't need to come if you don't represent anybody. So I knew that would kind of get him a little bit because he thought he was a big shot. See?
Yeah.
So, and head of the Klan, you know, that was big time. And so he heard that. Do I have to work with that woman? I said, well, I mean, I haven't even asked her yet to do this. I'm after you, the person I need right now. And he said, yeah, I think I'll do this. So I called the AFL-CIO man back and said he thought he was going to do it. And he said, okay, let me talk to him. So that went on for 2 or 3 days. I went back to talk to Ann. And her thing was, I ain't going to put up with that cracker. I mean, I can't, ain't no way in the world I can do that. I said, that's not the issue. The issue is, how are you going to represent the folks who need you most about school desegregation? So we had maybe 3 or 4 meetings. And we had some other people that I knew that was on this committee. And of course, when we had the meetings, they did not say very much for each other. We just talked about the process. The process is a 10-day process. And we identify the problem. We bring the people to a site that we will pick, and they will, you know, talk about how we can get this done, and that each of you then will have the opportunity to manage your group and the opportunity to decide how you want to say what it is you need to say. And that was the selling point. That was the selling point. And the charrette was held in the black community, but the school was basically new. I think it was about a year old. And that's where we held it. The first day, was the hardest work day I have had in my life. And I'm an old person. And I've had some difficult times that day. And see,
what made it so hard? Came,
these two people.
That CP Ellis and
one
Ann.
Couldn't say one thing without the other one saying, oh, hell no.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on all day.
Mm-hmm.
All day. I left disliking both of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I came home that night and said, I don't have to do this. I'm not that poor. I ain't got nothing. And but I can make a living doing something else. Mm-hmm. And I think my wife might have said to me, you have a lot of biases against these people. Why don't you get yourself straight?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have to pause you right there. I have to pause that. That's one of the questions I wanted to ask you. Is like, how did you, so there you are, you go home, you go to a hotel, or you go, you know, you go somewhere to rest. Yeah.
Well, I'm just 20 miles away. See?
Oh, you're talking about, okay. So you go home. I could go home. So you go home and you're like, I don't like him. I don't like her. I'm not doing this. And your wife says, you need to get yourself straight. You're biased. Now, how did you, as a Black man, feel safe, feel centered, feel opened to share space with Klan members? And at the same time, to work on your bias with Anne, just as a human, just being frustrated with her. How did you, what was that like with yourself?
The Klan, you know, I grew up in a section of Eastern North Carolina where if you were not a Klansman, you couldn't be a sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been, ever since I was old enough to know people, I knew white people. Worked in the field with him, who had this blanket hate. Unless you were doing something for them that they're going to make some money off for you. So I was used to that.
So you
that wasn't new to me.
You had that capacity.
I had lived, built. Yeah, I had lived a life through that. Plus the fact I went to North Carolina State to do master's degree work. I could sit down at a table that hold eight people at one end and white people, two guys at the other end. When I'd put my tray down, they'd get up and leave. So I had lived through all of that. And Ann was a little bit new to me because I had worked in civil rights activities, you know, you know, I was at A&T when we started the sit down, and you know about that, I'm sure. I mean, I was a student there then. So the issue with Ann was okay. It was her attitude that I disliked. Everything has got to be like she wants it. And the same problem, you know, how are we going to do this? And how many Black people going to come? How many white people gonna come? And all of that, that first day just bore me out. So I did hear my wife. I heard her clearly. And I spent that night, I maybe got 2 hours of sleep, dealing with me. If you are going to be successful, and that was a word that was in my mind. You have to be successful because you make a living doing this stuff. You have to be successful. You can't give up. I went back the next day and I wanted to be an example. I wanted to be an example to them. And my treatment to them changed drastically. You know,
what did that look like? What was the change like for you?
The change was hard because, you know, I was fairly young then. You know, I had been through a lot.
Yeah.
And I just thought people had more real sense than that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that there were a group of people still at the base.
Mm-hmm.
When you know that they still at bat, and I'm on third base.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I had to recognize that I got to go back to them in the sense of your thoughts,
yeah,
and feeling. And I did that.
I'm sorry to cut you off.
No problem.
I'm so interested in this because, you know, when I'm watching the movie and you're being depicted in the film, and I'm thinking to myself, like when I'm seeing this depiction of you, I'm thinking, okay, this is a human being that has a high tolerance, high capacity for discomfort, for with disagreements, for social awkwardness and tension. And when you're talking about how by that time you have become so used to being essentially the reciprocal of hate, right? You became so used to that. So in a sense, it's like, who could have been better than you to already have that practice of like, they hate me, I'm not going to pay that any mind, to go into a place like this and have these two opposing sides essentially start speaking to each other, right?
I think that my worst problem was disrespect for thy attitude.
Mm.
That was killing me. Just disrespect. And you know, I was raised in a religious family. And my mama said, when you don't know what else to do, pray.
Mm.
Now, I didn't do that often, but I did that night.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you did.
I did that night. The next day, I went back to work with a better attitude and started to offer the respect to them that I was hoping to get back from them.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
And that, if I had to pick one thing that made this a success, then that would be it. That I had to change my thinking and my biases in order to understand where they stood, and then what is your plan to make this work? My first plan was to give them things to do they had to do together. Some of it was kind of silly, like, stapling papers together, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, and see, I wouldn't say just staple. I said, well, you get over there, and I'm going to put the pages out, and y'all can stay with a hand under each other. It started like little stuff like that.
Yeah.
Then we ran into a little difficulty. Ann wanted to do gospel music as we got started at night, because that's when your most folks are going to come.
Yeah.
And he said, what? I can't handle that music, because I don't like that music. I said, okay, what would you like to do? He said, well, I let me just talk to you about this. So he didn't want to say it in front of Ann. So before the end of the day, he said, I'd like to bring all my stuff, my clan stuff, you know, the hood and all that stuff, and put it up in the hall so everybody can see it. And I went, oh my God, don't tell me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said yes. Talked to Ann about it, and she was close to calling me a coward, you know, and we got a little angry about that. I mean, I got a little angry about that you're so shut down until you're going to bring gospel music. It's just as radical to him as it is to you to bring his stuff.
See, that's the part right there, though. I have to pause again, because that's important. You know, because I remember watching the film and thinking about this moment to sit with you leading up to this moment. and how a beautiful thing about the Shrek process and about any good conflict resolution process is understanding that each person has something what's sacred to each person to the other is offensive, right? Like when there's opposition. And it's exactly. Like how to move the offensiveness and find, okay, it's sacred. That's sacred to him. This is sacred to you. Let's honor it and see where this goes. That's what you did in that moment.
I did that. And that was one of the major steps. But what happened was he brought the stuff and I said, you got to watch it. You got to have somebody here to watch it. And he did. He had a youth core group that watched it. But I don't know how this happened. And they didn't know that I was even in the building, I don't believe. But a group of young black guys was getting ready to tear it down. And Ann rushed out of the office. And they had an office together. And he stood in the door because he was a little bit afraid to go out there with these guys. And she preached them down, man. I mean, and she knew two or three of them by name. Why don't you start reading some of this stuff so you can understand how other people think? Nobody really knows that I see this because I stepped back. I could hear it, but I didn't see them. And that went on for about 20 minutes. And she made them put every piece back where it was. And I saw, you know, that was really okay. How she did that was really okay with CP.
How was that for you to witness that? That's powerful. What was that like for you emotionally or just to see that happen? That's a huge shift.
I was really happy.
Yeah.
I was really going, oh, yeah, yeah. At one time, they both agree on something. And for Ann, that is a big step.
Huge step.
Huge step. And so we never talked about it. They never knew I saw it. but as my mother would say, the Lord just bless you, son.
Yeah.
In that situation.
And I'm assuming CP seeing her respect what was sacred to him shifted something in him.
It did.
Right?
It did.
Did you notice that from that day on? It really did.
They started to talk to each other while they were giving these little jobs that I had them do. Now, every day I would think up something that they had to do together. They had to do it together. And that went on for about 8 days.
How long are these 10 days? How many hours?
The children come about noon. We always have a youth group. The real charrette actually start about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. And normally by 10 o'clock, we're finished. Problems other than just school desegregation. We were doing books that were going from white schools to black schools. We were talking about healthcare. And I had an expert in each of these rooms. See, on the first night, we talk about all the things we get from the crowd. What is it you want to talk about that makes your community better? Obviously, the whole goal here is school desegregation, but you have to look at all the other issues that go with that. You can't leave that by itself.
That's right.
So there were lots of other issues. Not lots, but we won't do more than 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. And with the big problem, then we'll take on another 4. And education, desegregation and education, 2 different things. Mm-hmm. You know, because white kids are being taught one thing, black kids taught something else.
And I'm thinking, especially the white kids, their books are being taught something about the black kids. So it's like there's so much in there that needs to be changed if they're going to integrate.
For sure.
Yeah.
So in essence, then, as it got toward the end of this charrette, everybody was bringing their folks. you know, everybody, his folks kept coming, mm-hmm. her folks kept coming, and things were, we didn't have an agreement, but things were at least livable. And the last night, my first idea was to close it myself, because I still could not trust them to be fair with each other. I could not do that. And walking into the room that night, it was just something in my head say, man, these are adults. You cannot take that place. Your job here is to manage, not to produce.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're here to produce. So I gave them, and I had asked them to write something down and let me see it. I didn't realize that neither one of them knew how to write. I don't mean you can't sign your name. I was asking them to do something that was common to me.
Yeah.
But they had never written anything down they were going to say. They just get up and say it.
Right.
And I wanted to just slap my face for saying that, for asking them to do that, because neither one of them did it. Okay, are you ready to do your part tonight? Yeah, yeah. I didn't go back to ask, well, why didn't you write it down? Because right. I knew then that I had asked them to do something that neither one had the will to do and maybe the ability to do.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you one other thing before I get to the end of this. And knew a lady. He was having problems with one of his children. And the child had some disabilities and was not confined, but in a home. And that's true. He had a roommate they put in there that ran him crazy. Well, she knew the lady who was the manager, not manager of the whole place, but manager of that section.
So I want to be clear so people listening understand. So CP, the clan leader, had a son who had a disability and he was in a hospital or a home. And,
a home, yeah.
And a roommate got put into that home and it was driving the boy crazy. And that was upsetting, yes. CP. And Anne had, right. a friend who managed that area that, of the hospital. That, what's that
she
again?
Went to see her.
She went to see her.
The ward.
The ward. Got it.
She went to see her.
Wow. And
the movie is correct. The movie is correct. And I didn't know this until after the charrette was over with.
Oh, wow.
And I'll tell you how I found out that happened. So she got the kid moved. And he got upset by that. Not terribly upset, but don't button my family anymore. You know, and that kind of thing. So I think that softened him too.
Mm.
I think that softened him too. So this last night, I'm scared, but I'm prepared to set both of them down and talk about what we had accomplished, which was really not much.
Mm-hmm.
And we made some friends. That we got some folks who are talking to each other who had never talked to each other. And that was a big step forward, but it did not solve the issue that I went there to solve. And Anne did her little talk, wasn't long, 5 or 6 minutes. And I was pleased with that. And CP got up. Now I'm scared. Heart beating a little fast. And I'm standing I can reach out and touch him. And he said, you know, this whole thing has been an eye-opener to me. And if I thought that, he pulled out his little car and said, if I thought that tearing up this car would solve the integration problem, I would do it, and I think it would.
This is his Klan's card, to be correct.
Klan's, man, I'm about to go crazy, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sitting there with tears in my eyes, and he's trembling, and he takes it out, and he rips it. Man, let me tell you, still, you know, I got three children, and I've watched them all graduate from college and get married and get divorced and get married again. You know, there have been very few things that have even happened to me in my family that pushed me to where I was that night. I don't even have words to describe exactly how I felt when I saw him rip that car. And
it must have changed your life.
It did. It did. What it said was, what it said to me is that if you get yourself right, you might help other people to be better. And when I go back and look at it, you know, all these years, that changed me as a therapist and as a person. It changed me as much as it changed him. You know, I spent my last 18 years at UNC Chapel Hill, working in student health, helping kids with drug problems and all of that. But out of all of that, and over the years, I sat down, my wife and I, because my wife was an English teacher, and see, I can't spell and don't know how to write a whole sentence. She did my master's thesis for me.
Nice.
And I decided that I would come up with a way people can get around and become better, and created six essential skills that every person need in order to be all right with themselves and all right with that society. And I taught that as a course at Carolina.
Will you tell us those six skills? Do you want to share that?
Okay, I'll make sure I can remember them all. The first one is negotiating primary and secondary relationships. The big key there is the people you invite into your life is a big issue. Mama and dad and all of that can go wrong sometimes, but it's pretty stable. But we mess up when we promote people to be a major part of our lives. And that's a crucial piece. But you will never reach your goals in life as an individual until you invite somebody in your life that's not kin to you.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's Bill Ritty's theory. And it comes from my own experiences. I didn't go out and do a whole lot of research, but I came to that conclusion. And
your life was the research you lived in.
And of course I read books from everywhere about relationships. That's the first one. The second one is self-awareness. all of us should own the spot of ground we stand on. No matter what it is in your mind, whether you lack tall people, hate short people, that little spot is yours. And you have the opportunity to make that little spot into something that is useful for the world. And so you have to understand where you stand, who you are, and what it is you want to be. And that's it. That's my second piece. My third piece is communicating feelings. We talk all the time. We enjoy talking. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to how we feel, we tend to shut down. We can do pretty good when we're angry. We can do pretty good when, you know, we think somebody has mistreated us. But 50, 60% of the time, we talk about what's logical rather than how I feel.
That's right.
And you have to get closer to how you feel in your conversation. Okay, that's what, three?
Three.
Okay. The next one, well, the last one is spirituality. So I got two more in the middle. Dealing with disappointment and failure. Mm. No matter who you are or where your little spot is, there are going to be some days that are not good. And how you receive that and how you examine yourself and examine your environment will determine how successful you are. So you know that's going to be some hard times. And the fifth one is decision making. That's a tough one. That is a tough one. And see, what people don't realize, you make decisions based on how you value stuff. If I'm a drug head, then I value the drugs. That's my first priority. And that's how I'm going to make my decisions. Mm-hmm. So rather than trying to teach people how to do that, let's look at what you value and let's reorder that to where what you value is productive to you and be productive to the people who know you. And spirituality is what I saw when your picture came on the screen. Mm-hmm. I saw a smiling face. I saw a person who has his own little spot. I can tell by the little three dots in your face and your head. I can tell that you're your own person, that you're not trying to impress anybody, that this is you. And there's nothing wrong with that. If more of us could do that, then I think this world would be a much better place to live.
Oh, thank you for that. I'm honored to have heard your six skill sets, and I'm honored to be seen by you. Yeah, because I do feel all those things you said about me. That I take that as a compliment.
I like it.
I take it as a compliment.
That's how it is. I have never, the whole issue of us, me, you, the whole issue of the individual to be who you are. And you're much better off when people know that. And it doesn't take a lot of conversation. That's your spirituality peak. See, it doesn't take a lot of conversation for us to choose what it is about you we like and don't like. See,
I agree. It's really a way of being, isn't it? It's just like a presence.
You walk in a room and everybody in there in 4 or 5 seconds have made a determination.
But that's interesting. That speaks to that speaks to the pivotal moment in that 10-day process in Durham when you decided, I'm going to go respect them. That, to me, that's very spiritual, right? To go in there and spend the whole night before working on your biases and releasing those, and then treating them like two equal people that you're going to respect. Like that's a spiritual move that they both felt, and that started shifting things, right?
I believe you're exactly true, man. I believe that as I look back at it, and it's necessary. I've done some travel and lots of Zoom about the movie, and people ask, what can I do to be a better person in the sense of race? And I said, you know, just look in the mirror. And you know, Michael made a song about it, the man in the mirror. but here we're talking about people. We're just not talking about men. We're talking about men, women, children. Look in the mirror. Look at what your biases are and try to deal with them. I don't think you're going to get rid of them all in a day. But when you start to recognize that you have them and that, you know, is fair to all the people that you see, then you need to do something about yourself. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, I don't have enough hatred to go around for white people. You know, ain't that much hatred in the world.
Yeah.
But I the individual for who he is. And if I disagree with his philosophy about that, I have a right to just walk away from it. I do not have a right to degrade him. I don't have a right to call him big names that you see in the newspaper every day. I just have the right to take him out of my sphere. That's the right.
I love that. I mean, I think that's the wisdom that I, you know, even when you were talking about the sit-ins, when I think of those really early civil rights movements, the nonviolent movements, right. I'm always so moved by them because there is this constant practice of reattuning to yourself and staying clean within you. Like Maya Angelou always said, you find a place within yourself, you keep that place clean. And so, and you live in that place, like you're talking about that spot, that little space of yours, and you sit and you live in that integrity. And so no matter what anyone says about you or does to you or thinks of you, you have that space, right? It's not about them as much as it's about you. And I think that's brilliant. I mean, I look to the nonviolent civil rights movement for so much inspiration and teaching because of that piece, that it's such a special piece. And even the way you just said that, it comes from that lineage, doesn't it? Of saying, like, I don't have the right to hate you or ruin you. I have the right to move away from you. It's a different way of responding, isn't it?
I think so. Plus, it enhances your little spot.
That's right.
That little spot you have chosen to stand on, you can walk away and slap yourself on the back that, oh, yeah. I made it through that one.
That's
I didn't curse anybody. I know that what they might have done was wrong, but they don't think it's wrong right now. And so by me just walking away might just inspire them to say, well, I did say something rather nasty to him and he kept walking.
Mm.
That might have an effect.
Yeah.
The effect the people, the person is looking for is response. See?
That's right.
And I joke with my grandchildren now that everybody got a gun, so you don't need responses. And I laugh about it, but it's the truth. That it is crazy that somebody cuts you off in traffic and you shoot them.
Agreed.
That's just crazy to me. My whole philosophy is, obviously, if somebody is trying to harm you, you have to respond. But otherwise, I can repair my broken, stuff that is in my mind So that's how I take it, and that's how I do it.
That's right. I just want to thank you so much for your time. It's been so beautiful sitting with you. If I'm ever driving south, I'm gonna call you.
All right,
maybe go for a walk together, get some tea. It's really nice
now
to
where,
be here.
Where you live now?
I'm in New York.
You're in New York.
Yeah,
upstate. Yeah, we did the film. I was for 3 days up on Fifth Avenue. Everybody interviewing and all that stuff. And I hadn't been to New York in about 20 years.
Wow.
But it's the fastest town in America. Everybody in a hurry.
It is so. I left the city because of that. I live in the mountains now.
All right.
Yeah, but yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Everybody's in a big hurry to go somewhere. So, but I've enjoyed this.
Yeah, thank you, my friend. I'll reach out in the future again.
If you ever come south, you know, I'm easy to find.
I can just tell. I have your number.
Just Google it and somebody is, oh, yeah, you're trying to call in there.
Okay, my friend, you take good care. Thank you so much.
All right. Enjoy it, man. Take care.
So there's the interview with Bill. I really hope you enjoyed it. And it's just so profound that in 10 days, a man that spent his life racist in the Klan and became a leader of the Klan was able to rip up his card in front of all the Klansmen and racist white people in his town to say, we have more in common than I ever believed we did. And like Bill said, like the movie shows, what really led him to that behavior was being respected. It wasn't being yelled at. It wasn't being canceled. It wasn't being judged. Bill was the first one to show him respect. And then Anne was able to show him respect when she told those boys in the hallway, you're not going to tear this down. You're going to read this. You can understand what leads to him believing this about us. And if you didn't understand when Bill was explaining, C.P. Ellis, the Klan's leader, was in the doorway watching her do that. He was shocked that she was actually defending the Klan table with their brochures and costume and bigotry, you know, on posters and such. She was defending that station out of respect for what was sacred to C.P. Ellis. Now, that's radical. And then the final one, C.P. Ellis had a son who was disabled in a ward, and the son was being driven mad by a roommate. And Anne had a friend in the ward who worked there, who managed it, and she had the woman remove this roommate so C.P. Ellis's son could have some rest. And even though he was defensive and said, stay out of my business, there was still this moment of, wow, this person showed me respect. This person that I have been railing against and hating and spreading hate about and believing was less than me has shown me grace. Something changes in us when someone shows us a kindness, because these expressions of hatred, they come from traumatic experiences that lead us to believe someone's less than us, or I must be better than them, or I'm scared of them, so I need to hate and teach others to hate. And we're doing that now in our country, in America. We're doing it to the Republicans. The Republicans are doing it to the Democrats. The vaccinated are doing it to the unvaccinated. The masked to the unmasked. And back and forth. And it teaches us by doing that, again, to match the frequency of opposition and hate. When instead, what if we just showed each other a little bit of grace, a little bit of kindness, even if we don't understand it? Can I love you without understanding you? Can I believe you are valuable, even when how you live or what you believe is so opposing to how I live and what I believe? Are you of equal value? Does the tree rail against the lightning that strikes it at its core? No, it falls to the ground and gives its body to the earth to propagate a new generation. There's an endless non-dual generosity that exists in the forest. And in these moments, in these films, in these situations with these teachers, I learn and am reminded every day that that generosity, that's what adds to our lives. That's what keeps us straight with ourselves, regardless of what other people do. But more chances than not, the other people get affected by that. They feel touched, whether they have the capacity to hold that or not. So I thank you for being with me on this very special episode. And I'm very curious where this takes you. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. My question for you is, where do you feel the episode? Take a breath and just notice, what's your body doing right now? Sit with it, let it speak to you, and let whatever comes up, come up. And your only job is to listen. For all the wisdom you need is right inside of you. For more information on my work, including my online courses and healing circles, please visit holisticlifenavigation.com. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook, where I share weekly philosophies and resources to help you release stress and trauma from your body so that you can live a happier life. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you next time.